Ready graphics? Ready theme?
Hi, I'm Jessie Mullins.
And I'm Lauren Milberger.
And this is FYI,
the Murphy Brown Podcast.
If you wish to lodge a complaint, press 3.
Much like God, Murphy doesn't prank people more than they can handle.
Frank, don't eat the donut!
Oh my gosh, Craig Bierko, heartthrob of the 90s.
And on today's episode,
we'll be talking about Season 3, Episode 8, Rootless People.
Hello, 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 and welcome.
Welcome, rootless people, or roothead people.
What?
It's okay if some of you are, I don't know. Hello, people who might be ruthless or rootless or have roots.
Well,
and Ruth.
When I think of this episode, I just think of the Bette Midler movie Ruthless People, which I know is not really what they're referencing. It's just a saying, yeah. Ruthless people. But and we do love puns on this show.
We love a pun. I actually loved thinking this title for a while.
it's quite clever.
It is very clever. It's layered.
Or as I like to call this episode, The Murphy Who Cried Wolf.
Oh my gosh. It's an episode of comeuppance.
And she deserves it. You know,
yes.
There's something that recently on a podcast that I found, it was an old podcast, but that I found recently where Candace Bergen said that she particularly would be at the writers to make sure that Murphy learned something in the end, that like she didn't always win, so to speak, for her bad behavior. And I thought that was really interesting because that's something we talk about, right, that is important to the show. And it seems like she was the driving force to be like, I know it's a comedy. She should not be rewarded for her terrible behavior.
Yeah, and I think there's something really jumping ahead a bit, but like the idea that this is such a great way to teach Murphy a lesson because while the stakes are very high, there's also no actual danger.
Yes.
Like we're never worried that she's actually going to get hurt. This is the most like irritating way you could be. you could have to face what you've done to yourself and people's trust in you.
A lot of that is not just in the writing and the casting and who these guys are who are kidnapping her. It's also the fact that Murphy is never afraid. Yeah, I'm fine.
You know, I think one of the things that could have been a trap with the show is that Murphy very rarely descends from the place of position of power.
Mm-hmm.
But what I like about this is like that position of power, that dynamic is what keeps us comfortable in her hijinks and in their hijinks with her as the victim of this episode, because I'm not worried that she's not going to be okay, but I am really enjoying how stuck she is.
Yeah. Yeah. It's more of an annoyance, really.
Watching her know that she knows exactly how to get out of this and that it might just take some time is also fun because we're like, yeah, she's fully capable of exiting the situation if she needs to.
Yeah. And she believes in their cause, right? She
yeah.
knows that they're harmless for a lot of reasons other than their personalities and the way that they're doing this.
Their sweet, sweet personalities. Yes.
So this episode is a little complicated in the writing credits. Mm-hmm. So the story by Lisa Chernin and Saidu Kane and Denise Moss, obviously on staff this year. But the teleplay itself, the written script, is by Saidu Kane and Denise Moss. Now, this could be a technical contract issue where maybe it was a spec script or a freelance person where it was written so much or changed so much, right, that it becomes a shared credit, or it is an idea that they came up with together. We asked and no one could really remember what the credit issue was, but it's interesting how sometimes it can just be, it can just come down to legally with the WGA how credits go.
Credits are fascinating. They can also be exhausting and frustrating, but they are really fascinating when you look at this, like who literally gets the credit for what element.
It is directed, as always, well, for a limited time.
We're getting to the point where we might not say as always soon.
We're getting there. You know, we have a whole other season, but like it's getting closer. Directed by Barnett Kelman, and it aired November 19th, 1990. Now, something interesting is there are some articles where Diane is interviewed about the upcoming season, and she talks about how she thinks that people like to see issues from the news and things that affect them personally. The topicality of our shows is one of my favorite things about Murphy Brown. And I think that it was really smart to sort of, you know, you kind of forget that this is sort of an issue episode because it's so wrapped in this sort of, and I'm not sure if I want to say farce because like it's not like it's Frasier, right? But it's a really kind of silly comedy in a way of errors of them trying to, I say trying to kidnap her. I mean, they kidnapped her, but they really kind of did it.
Yeah.
Yes. And as a reminder, before we start, You can watch this episode. You can go to our website and there's a link on the homepage.
Please do. And then let us know if you agree with some of our thoughts as we go.
All right. So we start with our, again, I want to say usual montage, but you know what? Not so usual these days.
No.
It is sort of something that doesn't necessarily connect to the episode except for sort of easing us in, which is why I think it was cut from syndication a lot. And I am only seeing this for the first time a couple of years ago.
Isn't that weird?
It's weird.
It's weird to have stuff like that happen. It gets me really excited.
I probably saw it when it aired, but because I didn't record it, I didn't remember that this was a thing. Mm. So we start with Mama Said by the Shirelles with the famous lyric, "There will be days like this. Mama said there will be days like this." As we open up on Miles buying flowers, we assume for Audrey.
Oh, yes.
On a very obvious Warner Brothers backlot.
Incredible.
Do you see the Rome columns in the background?
I was wondering about that. I wasn't sure if they were supposed to like indicate a bank or something that sometimes
Or like
some
Washington,
like
D.C.
Corinthian Roman call, you know, like that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think that it's probably was something for that they figured would just look like Washington, D.C. But because I know the Warner Brothers lot, I was like, I think that's where they filmed a lot of the Ben-Hur stuff.
Yes, I was looking at that. I was like, well, I think this is supposed to imply kind of like FIDI, the financial district kind of thing, where you have these like grant, they were just like, people will buy it as these grand financial institutions.
But long story short, Miles watches his car being towed away behind him. He tries to run after it and he can't get it. So Miles is not having a good day. He's having a day that Mama told him about.
Mama sure did say. Speaking of what Mama said, so Mama said, funny enough, was something I had to double check with Lauren because we had an episode already called Mama Said, famously, and I couldn't remember if this song was in it or not. And I remember us having that exact conversation when we did that episode about, why isn't that song in here? Too on the nose. Our folks here are not on the nose, people. We're clever. So Mama Said is a song before by, as previously stated, the Shirelles. It was from the album The Shirelles Sing to Trumpets and Strings. It was written by Luther Dixon and Willie Denson. It was a top 10 hit, both on pop and R&B charts, released in 1961. It went to number 4 on the Billboard Hot 100, number 2 on the R&B chart. It has been covered by so many people. It has been covered by American Spring, Melanie, Dusty Springfield, The Stereos, The Growlers, Dion Bromfeld. My favorite fact about it is that it was the inspiration for the song Days Like This by Van Morrison.
Oh, interesting.
Because
that makes sense.
Of course, when you think about it. Yeah. But I love that like Van Morrison was inspired by the Shirelles. Like I love when musicians reference each other and nod to other disciplines, because of course they do. Like, of course they do. Final thing about that is it was named the 44th song on Billboard's list of the 100 greatest girl group songs of all time.
Of course. I mean, when I think of the Shirelles, this is the first song. Well, I shouldn't say that. I think it's tied with Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow?
Yeah. It's iconic.
Yeah. And also when I think of that song, I also think of Carole King, whereas this song, I only think of the Shirelles.
Yeah.
So I had promised the last time we talked about the Shirelles to talk a little bit about Florence Greenberg.
Oh, yeah.
Because I think that her story is really interesting. But I found out something that will make us, I think, both laugh, which I thought was a really great addition to the story through this book that I'm starting to read called But Will You Love Me Tomorrow? An Oral History of the 60s Girl Groups by Laura Flam and Emily Sue Leibowitz. It's an oral history book, so it's all first-person stuff, which is great, from interviews that they did and also from archival interviews.
What I love about this is we both have plans to read this book, but Lauren started before me, and knowing that there was a surprise factoid that was going to come out, I actively had not picked it up yet because I was so excited for Lauren to tell me whatever this is.
Yeah,
thing
and
is.
I literally said to Jesse, I'm so excited to tell you this information that I found. And I honestly was like, well, if I'm going to talk about Florence Greenberg, I should probably read the book because I bet they have information that I don't know. Now, interesting enough, my first introduction to Florence Greenberg was a line item in the 90s because Bette Midler wanted to play her in a movie, because long story short, and I'll get more to it, Florence Greenberg was a housewife in her 40s in 1957, a Jewish white housewife who decided to start a record label, which in 1957, or at least the late 50s, was a big deal.
Yeah, unheard of.
She wanted to play Florence Greenberg, and En Vogue was going to play the Shirelles.
Oh!
I know.
Oh, come on. That would have been so good.
Eddie Murphy came to her with the project. They were going to co-produce it with their companies. I don't know if there was going to be a role for Eddie in it. And then it just never happened. Now, my scrapbook is filled with a lot of, you know, projects for Bette Midler that never happened because it, I think, you know, well, one thing, you know, Hollywood, but also just in the 90s, it was always like, oh, these women's pictures are flukes. Yeah, they're all just flukes. Anyway. Yeah.
Not popular at all.
Recently found out that it actually was due to the fact that they couldn't get all of the Shirelles to sign off on it.
Oh, well, yeah, I can see that.
That's fair. It's your life. You don't want them to do it.
Lived experiences and perspectives that I'm probably hard to all agree on a single presentation of that event.
Yeah. So here is the story of Florence Greenberg. Florence Greenberg was a New Jersey housewife in Passaic, New Jersey, and her daughter went to school with the Shirelles.
So cool.
Now, the way that I'd always heard the story up until reading this lovely book was that her daughter came home and was like, you got to listen to this group. They're amazing. And then she started this record label. Now, whether that's the truth or I just inferred just based on the information, I mean, there's also a Broadway show, 2011 with Beth Level. Was a jukebox musical. So I'm getting dramatization versions of the story. This is not. Mm-hmm. She had already started this record label and had one person, but they just weren't really anyone that we would know. Mm-hmm. And her daughter did come home and say, you gotta, you know, see this group. But what cracked me up was really what was happening was her daughter, this white Jewish girl, was following these girls home saying, you gotta sing for my mom. You gotta sing for my mom. And they were like, oh, no, here comes Mary Jane again.
They're like, please stop.
And so they were actively trying to avoid this girl.
Oh. I mean, fair.
Right? Fair.
All the things implied in that, fair.
Beverly Lee said, we got tired of her chasing us. We would separate sometimes saying, here comes Mary Jane.
Oh. Yeah.
We would dodge this girl. We would go a different way home from school.
I mean, that's fair.
So like, fair.
Without hindsight, I'd be like, girl, stop.
And even when they were like, well, who's your mom? What's the name of her record label? And she would be like, it's called Tierra. And they would be like, we've never heard of this label.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
But what I think is lovely is that they really did grow very fond of Florence and that she was very supportive. Mm-hmm. They describe her as a very motherly figure. Even, you know, back then to get your record played and, you know, make it a hit, you had to physically go to the radio stations, sort of wine and dine them, not literally, pitch but try it. To get them, convince them. And even the DJs were like, oh, she was like this mamala. She was like personable and like really fun and would give you hugs. And like, she was just like your mom. So her being this housewife actually helped. Now, that being said, she also had experience, you know, having worked for political campaigns. I'm not really sure if it was like she was paid for it. Most likely she probably was volunteering, but I don't have actual, you know, confirmation on that. And then so they released I Met Him on a Sunday, and through everyone's hard work, it became a big hit. She went on to start Spectre Records after selling, unfortunately, the Shirelles contract to Decca. I'm sure to probably make her money back, right? Then Decca was convinced that the Shirelles were a one-hit wonder and sold their contract back to Florence. And that's how she was able to start Spectre Records.
Wow.
She discovered Dionne Warwick through Burt Bacharach, who brought in a demo with her singing. The Isley Brothers' Twist and Shout. The Kingsmen's Louie Louie. Walk On By. You'll Never Fall in Love Again. Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head. Unfortunately, the company did fold in 1977. But as a woman in her 40s in the 50s, being the head of a record company, I think is pretty amazing.
That's incredible. That's so cool. What a cool lady.
I thought so, yeah.
And go Mary Jane.
Go Mary Jane, yeah.
Way to just march to the beat of your own drum, even if these women are like, please leave us alone.
All extremely fair. Who is your mom? I don't know. We are back in the episode. Miles just comes barreling in to the FYI bullpen. And I know that I may have said this already, but like this episode particularly just feels like classic Murphy in the way that all the characters are reacting. You know, like Grant is really at sort of his neurotic best, the way he sort of runs in, the little hand gestures, the, you know, really just being at his wit's end, but being believable, but also being like farcical and funny. I really love it.
Well, and I think it works really well because we see so little of them otherwise. That it was like, for the little bit that we see of them, they're going to be the most, like, typical of their character to really like cement the ensemble. And then they're basically just not in it the rest of the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Which we'll talk about in a little bit about, is this a bottle episode or not? Murphy's not in her office. And Frank is also waiting for her because it seems that someone, Murphy, put a handicap sign on Miles's car. And he spent half the night getting his car out. And he had tickets with Audrey to the Royal Lipizzan Stallions, which is pretty much dancing horses. Yeah. Which I didn't know. I had to look it up. I had never heard of
them. I love dressage. It's so cool.
It does look cool. In fact, Miles is upset that he missed the dancing sideways routine. And then he does his little hooves with his hands.
It's quite impressive.
He's really upset. You know, I looked them up and it said that they were still around. Also, the Google like business said that it was temporarily closed. So I don't know what that is, but they apparently have been around for a while. Now, Frank is upset because Murphy has been paying his dry cleaner to take in his pants an inch. This is horrible.
It's my favorite thing about the list of pranks that we get is they are also specifically perfect for each one.
Yeah.
The playing into Frank's neuroses by taking his clothes in. There's that phrase of like, God doesn't give us more than we can handle. Much like God, Murphy doesn't prank people more than they can handle. So now, like you look at Jim's, it's very tame compared to Miles, compared to Corky, because like she clearly caters them based on what would bug each person the most,
yes,
and what they can actually handle.
Yes. I think it was also interesting, which maybe we should write down for the next time we talk to someone behind the scenes, is we've talked before how they did do pranks on each other.
Uh-huh.
Particularly Grant and Candace were always acting like sophomores in a fraternity with each other, which is all I love. But I'm really curious. I mean, obviously, Candace didn't do things to this extent.
Uh-huh.
Did they do this based on what was happening behind the scenes?
Or, like, I want to know that somebody, like, went to wardrobe and had someone take in a pair of pants.
I hope it's not specific, right? But just the idea that this is in Candace. I mean, it feels so Murphy also. We've also talked about in the last couple episodes how the writers talked about taking things from people's personal life, you know, and this is just rife for comedy, right? Mm-hmm. But yeah, a lot of the stuff sort of reminded me of some of the stories we've been told. So then Corky arrives. Apparently she has been cut down by the wrath of Murphy because someone sent an autographed photo of her to Manuel Noriega. Manny, I'll be waiting for you when you get out. But then what's terrible is that right before Murphy comes off the elevator, Corky turns to Frank and goes, "You're getting fat, Frank."
You look fat, Frank. That's like Corky.
God. Oh, I was like, oh, God, honey. Actually, no, I'm sorry. It's Jim who comes off the elevator in a fat trench coat, right?
Oh, Jim looks incredible.
And he's like, lovely day.
It is when Jim walks in looking like that.
I have to say, he looks really great. He's in a great mood. And Miles says that it isn't a lovely day for obviously all of the reasons we've talked about. And Jim is like, oh, you know, I don't usually condone Murphy's hijinks, but journalism has a history of prankism.
We should learn to take it on the chin. And then he does a little like air chin chuck of
And then
Grant.
Murphy gets off the elevator looking so fabulous.
This outfit, like, it took my breath away. Every layer of this outfit, because we see it in different forms throughout. Incredible. It just got better.
Is it a tartan?
It's tartan adjacent. I don't know if it's, because technically tartan is a very specific.
It is. Okay. All right.
You have tartan designs that are registered and so on. It is a plaid.
A plaid. A green, fabulous plaid with a little blue in it. She's wearing black hose and a black shirt, which we can't see. And this sort of slate blue scarf, just like strewn. Sunglasses. She's in a great mood. Her hair is all fluffy.
Later when we see the necklace that's hiding underneath, also incredible. This like three-strand gold necklace that's like playing up the neckline.
And the gold belt too. Like gold looks fabulous on this. Black shoes. And holding a pink donut box. Now, we previously have talked about how we didn't understand why all the television shows had pink donut boxes.
Mm-hmm.
And then we discovered after that episode aired that there is a reason, which I would like to briefly talk about because it's fascinating. And funny enough, right when I found out about it, then Sunday Morning did this really great piece. Peter Yen of the Santa Ana Packaging, a local manufacturer of carnation pink containers, said, anytime you see a movie or a sitcom set in New York and a pink donut box appears, you know it obviously took place in LA.
Yep.
So the pink donut box has been a staple of Southern California donut shops for the last 40 odd years. As of last year, 80% of donut shops, which is well over 1,000 donut shops in California, particularly Southern California, are owned by Cambodian refugees who arrived in the U.S. in the late 1970s and early 1980s during the Cambodian genocide. And so pretty much there wasn't a lot of resources, as we know even today, for refugees. And so they all helped each other. And so the donut industry, which was already, you know, pretty much a thing. I mean, I think some people probably know Big Randy's Donut, you know, the big sort of donut mm-hmm. on top of the building from 1920s, 1930s, sort of, you know, trends in building. It's still a big landmark of the Los Angeles area. And so the tradition after that, from the late 70s to early 80s, really kind of took off even more and was carried on by the Cambodian community. Before this, boxes tended to be white, but pink donut boxes are cheaper.
Which is fascinating.
Right? Yeah. And so it became sort of a cost-effective thing. There even were some who said, well, I actually wanted a red box, but the pink boxes kept being sent and they were cheaper, so we went with pink. Now, the Los Angeles Times compared the pink donut box in the Los Angeles area as a comparison to the Grecian-style paper cups in New York.
Literally what I just thought of.
Now, there are some artisan donut places in Arizona and Texas who've taken on the pink donut box, although some printing companies think that places are now wanting to be more distinct. You know, branding is becoming more obvious to people.
And yeah, I was thinking about like the Dunkin' Donuts, like orange and that kind of stuff. Yeah,
exactly. And something that I read too was sort of pointing out the fact that like in the Northeast, where Dunkin' Donuts is a lot more popular, you have sort of the neon orange and pink box. And then in the South, you have Krispy Kreme, and you know it by the box. It's a polka dot box, whereas mm-hmm. this is sort of a blatant thing. Now, something that I thought was really amazing was there is this Cambodian-American artist, Feng Wei, who uses the pink donut box to draw portraits of the Cambodian community of second generation. And she has all kinds of beautiful stuff. I'll put a link to it. Some of the series has sort of a printing of them as children over it and this beautiful drawing of them as adults. And it was a way to honor their parents for what they sacrificed and the hard work that they did and how they didn't have time to really stop and take the applause, really. And it's really awesome and amazing. Yeah. So I, for one, hope that they don't get rid of the pink donut box, but I understand, you know.
Yeah.
Instagram.
That's so cool.
Yeah. There you go. So now we know why.
Well, we know. Hopefully it'll remain now as like a vintage thing.
Right? Yeah.
It'll come back and it'll be considered retro.
I remember watching the Night Court revival and mm-hmm. takes place in New York. Pink donut box.
So cool.
Yeah.
Now that people know, they'll notice it and everything.
Yeah, exactly. So Murphy offers Frank a donut, but you know, maybe he shouldn't. Oh, so horrible.
Can we also call out her Good Morning Vietnam yeah. entrance?
Oh, that's right. Oh, I forgot about that. She does.
Good
you want to explain
Washington?
To everyone who doesn't know the movie what she did?
Yeah. So, oh my gosh, I hope our listeners know the movie. 1987's Robin Williams' iconic movie, Good Morning Vietnam, where in every trailer you heard Robin Williams. I will not do a Robin Williams impression because that would be disrespectful of his memory. But he says a long drawn out Good Morning Vietnam that became, I mean, people who never even saw that movie when it came out in 87 knew that quote.
It's on the soundtrack. I had the soundtrack yeah. and in between the music, yep. they have his little sort of bits and he says that. Yeah.
And they, yeah. And it's referenced in movies and television. It's one of those quotes that I feel like generations know it without knowing what they're referencing. So I love when she walked in and did the like Good Morning Washington. I was like, when did that movie come out?
So it would be very much in the zeitgeist for sure.
Oh, yeah.
So Frank says that he knew what was going on, which, of course, we know he didn't. And then what I think is great is that he's like, I'm up to you. And then turns around and like unbuttons the top button and just takes a breath. Like it's such great acting from Joe.
So good.
Pretty much is that whenever Murphy finishes a story early, she uses sort of the bullpen and the people she works with as her own personal playground. He acts like a teacher, you know, I don't have to separate you. Murphy calls them killjoys, which I love, and uses J. Jim as an example that he's a really good sport. Apparently, she put a sign on the back of his car that says, honk if you want to spank me.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny. I paused it to write that down as, like, you just see Charles's, like, super sad face. Oh, and then when I unpaused it, I could see how quickly he just went to, like, realizing it. I thought, oh, that was great. He's like,
it's so, because again, it is the perfect prank for Jim. It is harmless, but that is just the most horrific thing he could imagine having on his car, that people would think that he would want that.
Of course, yes. He thought there was a wedding procession behind him. And then Murphy's phone rings and Frank says, you better get it. It might be Wile E. Coyote confirming your order from Acme Anvils.
It's so good. I hate that that reference might be lost to time.
It might be lost to town. Yeah.
It makes me so sad.
I hope that people still enjoy Warner Brothers cartoons.
Me too. Yeah. They're incredible.
But we should also remark that there is no secretary this episode, but there is a condemned sign.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, Murphy's kind of her own secretary for a second.
She is. You have reached the offices of Murphy Brown. If you wish to lodge a complaint, press 3. Now.
Now.
She's Jet GPT. But all of a sudden, Murphy gets serious, goes in her office, and Miles does something that I really empathize with when a show that I love has been canceled, which is, I need closure!
Yes.
Jim suggests that they send her on assignment really far away, where there are no telephones, mail services, or the possession of rubber dog doo-doo is a felony.
It's so good.
Corky just is at her wit's end. She can't live like this. Frank says that she's going to get them in their beds while they're sleeping. And then he does something so stupid. He eats one of the donuts.
He eats the donut.
With sprinkles. Frank, don't eat the donut.
That donut is from the before time, Frank. That Jeez, donut is I from know. The before.
He just said she's going to get them in their beds. So Murphy runs out. She has to go. And she says to show that, you know, even she knows when she's gone too far, don't eat the donut with the sprinkles. To which Frank just drops it like a hot potato and tries to, he doesn't spit it out though, but he tries to like get it off his lips. And yeah, I think he's going to spend some time in the bathroom. That's my guess.
I do believe, yes.
Yeah.
So we cut to what we find out is the exterior of the building that FYI is in, which is actually very interesting because we don't usually get the exterior. We don't get the street level. We get street level of Phil's, but we don't get street level of the FYI offices building. It is a true 80s, 90s Winnebago.
Oh, the detail on this is so great.
All I can think of is Randy Quaid in Christmas Vacation.
Oh, yes.
Like, this thing is lived in. It is not brand new. It has seen some time. I was also sent to, I just realized how many times Winnebagos or their non-brand name cousins are featured in, like, 80s, 90s.
So much.
Media. Because I then also went to Frasier. And Daphne Niles. I immediately was like, I know the insides of these things so well from just 80s and 90s media. And then we cut to the inside, which, by the way, this Winnebago is a TARDIS. This thing is enormous. You see the size of it from the outside, you get inside, and wow, that is some cushy living. That central living area is quite large, studio audience. I was like, oh, we're suspending disbelief here. We see three, I would say, rather despondent young men sitting on the couch. And I wrote, biggest Winnebago I've ever seen. There's a knock. They yell, who is it? They're very nervous. And we hear Murphy Brown from the other side of the door. The leader of the group, de facto at this point, Alex, played by one Craig Bierko, leaps from the couch to go answer, thanks her for coming, introduces himself. Another one who we haven't met yet, immediately, nervously, demands, what if she's been followed? Before we get into what they're talking about, just for those,
we got to talk about these actors.
So it's hard to introduce Craig Bierko. It's also hard to call him anything but Craig Bierko. Yeah. I don't know if I've ever really called him Craig or Bierko. He is Craig Bierko, a heartthrob of the 80s, 90s, and today. A tall drink of water, especially in like this era of Craig Bierko. Like,
this is his era.
Wow. What a tall stud he is. We were just talking about this before we started. I don't know where my crush on Craig Bierko as a child began. But it's there. He has been working for decades.
I feel like he just might have been that guy, like Matthew Perry, who was just in everything. It's just that Matthew Perry then got a lead show that lasted for long and people knew who he was. Because I was crushing on Matthew Perry before I really knew his name and like what, and then I watched Friends because I heard he was in it.
And I guess I should say, like, Craig Bierko obviously began working, as we all do, long before kind of those initial IMDb credits show up. But he really started working at the very end of the 80s. He has some soap stuff in the '73 and then some one-off episodes in the mid 80s, but really like 1989 is when he starts to hit. This episode is obviously in 1990, but he's in, I mean, he's in every TV show that was airing at this time. He's also in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. A notable role is in the project The 13th Floor.
I love that movie. It's actually a really underrated movie, 13th
Floor. It's incredible. He guests on Ally McBeal. He had two episodes in Sex and the City that I remember very clearly. What a Dreamboat. Scary Movie 4. He's in Nip Tuck. Boston Legal. He had quite
he's a working
15
actor.
Episode. I mean, he just worked in everything. He was in everything. He was also in the 2005 movie Cinderella Man. My favorite personal memory of Craig Bierko is that I saw him play Sky in Guys and Dolls when it was revived on Broadway.
I saw him in Music Man. He's really good.
Yeah. He was such a good, like, especially acting wise, but he was a really great Sky. He was opposite Oliver Platt as Nathan or Nate, and Lauren Graham was Adelaide. It was a really fun revival. I saw it during previews, but I just remember being like, oh my gosh, Craig Bierko, heartthrob of the 90s, is currently in front of me playing heartthrob of Guys and Dolls.
I just remembered something that I think will give people more context as well, is that speaking of Matthew Perry, he was the original choice for Chandler Bing, is my understanding.
Yeah.
Which is not really what he's playing in this, I would say, right? He usually plays a sort of like smart alecky, sort of sarcastic guys. But he's not the only like face recognition 80s, 90s actor in this episode.
No, he is not. So let me introduce them.
Please. Oh, yes, introduce them.
So this is Alex, Craig Bierko. As he thanks her, and these other very neurotic, nervous-looking men, who we will meet in a moment, are surrounding him, Murphy says, let's not waste any time. If what they claim is correct, she sits down. She's ready to take notes. Clearly, this is a big deal. They could be blowing the lid off of a very large story. That's the U.S. covert action in Chile, which would be a very serious charge. And she says, oh, I believe you said you have a dossier? Alex actually doesn't seem to know what a dossier means. Mm-hmm. And he actually says, no, correction, they actually don't have any information from the CIA, as they clearly claimed on the phone. They're environmentalists. They're with the Coalition to Preserve America's Resources. And at that moment, Murphy seems a little fed up. And so he rushes to introduce his colleagues here, as she has stood up and seems to be making her way to leave. First, we meet Dr. Elliot Niebling. This is a microbiologist who truly wilts under the direct gaze of Murphy Brown.
Yes. Oh, her beauty is too much.
It's so funny. It's that thing of like this incredible, stunning creature is in near you, and like you can kind of make your way, but the second they look at you, he just, and it happens later, he, as long as she's not looking directly at him, as long as he's not interacting directly with her, he might make it through this interaction. But the second that he has to actually introduce himself, I think everyone will recognize Dr. Elliot Niebling as played by
Curtis Armstrong, who I think at this point when this aired in 1990, more people would know Curtis than they would know Craig.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No, absolutely.
Curtis was born in Detroit, Michigan in 1953. Researching him for this podcast is that he comes from real acting training. He did Shakespeare, worked in a lot of regional theater. The first thing that I know him from, maybe not his... I don't want to say, I mean, he was fine in the movie, but we'll talk about in a second why the movie is not something you should go and watch him in, is he was Booger in the 80s films Revenge of the Nerds series, which I found out apparently when he was cast, he took great umbrage with the name and kept trying to get them to change his name. He says now everyone calls him Booger and he's fine with it. But his first film is Risky Business, which is like, wow, man.
What a first, man.
Yeah, and he has some famous lines in that film. That's from 1983 with Tom Cruise. But he also went on to do some real 80s classics with John Cusack, Better Off Dead, One Crazy Summer. But I think that most television fans will know him from his series regular role on Moonlighting.
Yeah.
Starring Sybil, not Candace Bergen Shepherd, which was a star vehicle for Bruce Willis.
Oh, yeah.
What's great about the timing of this episode is that right now, for the first time, you can go on Hulu and you can watch Moonlighting. And I Highly recommend it.
When I tell you, I am just waiting for the rewatches of Moonlighting to hit TikTok. Like, I am waiting for social media, for the people who are suddenly see it's there and start watching it to start reacting to it in today's lens. I cannot wait.
I feel like it's going to hold up.
Well, and I think it does a really good job of, it was very current of the time, but I think it also holds a very, this is of its time.
Oh, absolutely. Later, but I don't think it's going to be as offensive as the Revenge of the Nerds films, which are super
exactly.
rapey.
Exactly. I think Moonlighting, you're able to kind of hold it within the lens of when it was made easier. And I also think it was not as offensive in retrospect.
Yeah. But listen, there are a lot of things that, you know, we see a lot in television that had never happened before. Mm-hmm. Like, this is a dramedy. This has breaking the fourth wall. There's music. Like, it's a lot of things that later on you may not realize influenced the television that came after it. And I'm very mm-hmm. excited for people to remember when Bruce Willis was like adorable and funny.
Oh my gosh, he was such a good comedian. Yeah,
and Curtis is great in it too. He has a really great sort of love relationship with someone else in the office. Anyway, Moonlighting. Well, just watch him in Moonlighting.
That had been airing before this episode of Murphy Brown. So people really knew him.
In fact, some people might be like, oh, he's guest starring? It's a really meaty part in a big television show. Just because he used to be a series regular.
Well, he's guest starring and he's not the leader of the group, which is very interesting, but it makes sense with how they cast these types.
Yeah, but he tends to sort of play these sort of like outsider, nerdy, you know, kind of characters. Mm-hmm. And it makes sense that he wouldn't be the leader from his character type that he usually plays.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Based on the writing of it, but I think I could see people who don't understand the creating of an ensemble group being like, why did this notable guy get the smaller part? It's like, oh, it's not about that. Like, he was cast perfectly.
Yeah. And listen, he's continued to work. He's been on everything from The Simpsons to Third Rock from the Sun to Supernatural. He was in the Ray Charles biopic. He played the head of Atlantic Records. He's just a really great, you know, working actor.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of working actors.
Yes. After we meet Dr. Elliot Niebling, we meet Marshall Caldwell, who writes the newsletter for the Coalition. He's also a member of the Sierra Club, Common Cause, and Mothers for Nuclear Free World. I would say Marshall's the gentleman of the group. And he really holds down the gentlemanly interactions with a lady. And he wants to commend Murphy for not wearing ivory on her show.
And I would say, for those people who have listened to our interview with Mr. Steven Peterman,
mm-hmm.
or know what Steve looks like, so you can just like listen to the interview and then Google Steve. We have pictures of him on the interview on our website. Mm-hmm. That this is an actor named Andrew Hill Newman. And although he didn't move to LA until 1990, I feel like he would have gone up for every role that Steve, when he was an actor, would have auditioned for. And
every single role.
I would like to know if they knew each other, because we have had stories of Steve saying, oh yeah, I knew all these people because I would see them at auditions. And so like, I wanted to hire like my friends and my colleagues. Like, I wanted to give them mm-hmm. shots, you know, now that he could, right? But yeah, this is like a Steve role to me.
I also really want him to play a relative of Kevin Sussman.
Oh, yes. Now, what's interesting about Andrew is that he has gone on to be pretty well-known, prestigious writer, as well as occasionally still acting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I thought was funny is his first on-screen role is as the funny janitor at the end of Mannequin.
Yeah.
It's like a big film for me when I was a kid with Kim Cattrall. Highly recommended everyone should watch it. But he made his Broadway debut as an understudy for Nathan Lane and Doug Henning in a show called Merlin, which, if you know interviews with Nathan Lane, he's always mocking that his Broadway debut was in the magic show Merlin with Doug Henning, who was this famous magician at the time.
Yep.
But he did a national tours of Barnum and Big River and Master Harold and the Boys. And of course, he spent 2 years off Broadway as Seymour in the original production of Little Shop of Horrors.
Which, of course, he was. Look at him.
Yeah. I mean, he was a replacement. He wasn't, but still, like, that's pretty awesome.
But, like, look at him.
Ugh. It's perfect. If you look at his IMDb, he never stopped working.
Yes, he was in Murder, She Wrote. We got one.
There you go.
Got to get one an episode.
In 1997, he wrote sketch and monologue material for Saturday Night Live. He landed his first staff position in 98 for UPN series, Guys Like Us. He is actually one of the main producers on Brockmire, which was the series that Hank Azaria did. He did a lot of shows like iCarly. mm-hmm. Drake and Josh, you know, a lot of things that a lot of people I think listening grew up on, you know, at Nickelodeon, which, you know, eventually Steve went on to work on Hannah Montana. So this was a really great little rabbit hole to go down and learn about. Like, he's had a really awesome career.
I mean, we talk about this a lot, but I love being able to highlight actors like this who you might not know right away by name. You might be like, oh, that face seems familiar. But then you see how truly connected and prolific these people are, because this is something that came out of the recent strikes, is that the majority of working actors who are out there, you don't know by name and by huge credits. Like, they are working. And this is somebody who has had a career that is, I find, more enviable than a celebrity. This is an incredible career.
Absolutely. And this is what the strike was for, because what was happening for writers and actors alike, but for this situation, we're going to talk about Andrew, right? His career as before the strike was something that was becoming impossible, mm-hmm. because of the way that the money structure was happening because of, yep. streaming. And so this was to save the career of actors like Andrew coming up, yes. in the pipeline. And it's just great.
I love that we get to hear more about them. Yay. Yes. So Murphy is not moved by their greetings, and she goes to leave. But then they begin what is clearly the pitch that they have been bringing to any journalist who will talk to them. Alex begins. They've been fighting to save Las Rivas for 6 years. It's one of the most pristine stretches of wetlands in Oregon, and it's about to be destroyed for a 5-acre commercial development. Elliot tags in. Thank you, Alex. Now, this commercial development would drop millions of gallons of waste products into the waterway each year, creating a black hole of what used to be a rich ecosystem that represents the very womb of our existence. There's a half beat, and then Marshall just goes, they're going to build a Sizzler. Which, sidebar, is Sizzler still around?
Huh.
Because that is a reference to me that I'm like, oh, a Sizzler. I don't know if I've seen a Sizzler in 15 years.
Yeah, I was going to say yes, but then I realized I was thinking of the Red Lobster in Times Square.
Oh, we love a Red Lobster. So what?
So apparently there are only 107 locations in 10 states left.
Oh, Sizzler.
Which it started in 1958. This is courtesy of, oh, NPR. The name of the article is called Pandemic Fizzle, Sizzler Steakhouse Chain Files for Bankruptcy.
Oh, no. That's such a good headline, though.
Well, thank you for researching that for me.
You're welcome. Keep going.
So Murphy says that they didn't have to lie to her to get her interest. She says she cares about the environment. I separate my trash. I try not to use disposable products. And I never order a glass of water in a restaurant unless I'm choking.
I know I don't have time for this, but I don't understand why that's bad for the environment. Because is like the production of soda and wine less of your carbon footprint than water?
Or, yeah, or is it because we're in an area that's known to have droughts, so you don't want to like use too much water?
Oh, you're right. This is a joke about California that is not relevant to us in where we grew up.
Unless we're wrong, someone tell us.
Tell us, yeah.
And Marshall says he knew she would help. And this is where he says, you have kind eyes and you smell like sandalwood.
Which is such a benign line, but I found it so funny.
I had to write it. I thought it was so funny. So Murphy says she will take the materials, she'll check them out, and she promises that if they check out, they will cover it when the show has an opening. Alex insists that she doesn't understand. There are bulldozers ready to go. They need this story on tomorrow night's show. Murphy, and what I love is, like, we know through her history with Jake, Murphy is very sympathetic to these causes.
I was so thinking about Jake. He's even got the same, I think that the jacket he's wearing is something that Jake wears in the finale.
Like, I really think this is kind of just like a glimpse to like who she would have been with in her younger days.
Yeah.
She says she'd love to do that, but that's not how it works. The tomorrow's show is already set. As we know, she's had a lot of free time because she set up that interview. She says she wants to do an accurate story. So to do so, she needs to fly there herself, interview the parties involved. She needs to sort out the facts. And as she's listing these things, sweet Dr. Niebling just goes, I knew it. I knew it. She's giving us the brush off. He says she's just like all the other news people. Last year, the media couldn't wait to traipse all over the countryside, taking pictures of spotted owls and dying forests. Now they're all onto something new, like this Twin Peaks thing. Who cares who killed Laura Palmer? So she says that's a low blow. She does care. Give her the research, but she's got to go.
Yeah.
They're afraid they'll have to detain her.
Can I just say, though, I love that she's like, Plan B, what's Plan B? Like, it's not one of my necessarily like favorite episodes, but this is actually one of my favorite performances by Candace in this whole episode.
Later, when she's eating, will get is some of my favorite work that Candace has ever done on the show.
It's in my diary.
It's incredible. It's, oh my God, yeah, I love it so
the
much.
Eye thing, so yes. The eye thing, yeah, we got to talk yep. about the eye thing. Oh Agreed. My God, yeah, okay.
They say they're afraid that they'll have to detain her, and she bursts out laughing. She's like, what, kidnap me? And they say, yes, kidnap her. And what I love is these three, just, you know, are the gentlest men. Stand in a wall with their arms crossed, basically blocking her from the doorway. And she says, come on, guys, I know it's a good cause, but eco-terrorism isn't the way to get what you want. She looks around at the Winnebago and says, and let's be honest, we all know you're out of your league, and just gestures at the Winnebago. And Alex says, don't underestimate them. They've tried to work within the system. They've petitioned, they've protested, and now they've been pushed to their limit. They are desperate men. And I love it because this is some good Bierko where he goes from like funny to like genuinely, yeah. like speaking very sincerely.
And I also feel like because obviously we don't really get to meet these characters for more than just this episode in this particular mm-hmm. high pressure situation. But mm-hmm. the fact that they all vote on it, that it's like, yep. we are a democracy. We are the good guys. Yep. Like everything's going to be fair is like so telling of their dynamic. I thought that mm-hmm. was such a great little thing.
Oh, yes. And she hears that. She looks around and she says, you have a duckmobile. Desperate men don't have duckmobiles. Now open the door. At that moment, Elliot, not the one I thought would actually instigate the kidnapping, screams, take off, Sydney. Apparently, Sydney is the driver that we never meet, who's at the front of the Winnebago.
I kind of do love that we never meet Sydney.
Everyone kind of goes flying around. Now, I want to just take a little sidebar.
Yes,
please. To talk about eco-terrorism.
Yes.
We won't get too into it, but because this is long and complicated. And to be completely honest, I don't want to go too in-depth because a lot of things are alleged.
Fair.
So I don't want to claim anyone is a terrorist within reason. First and foremost, the important distinction for me is the difference between environmental terrorism and eco-terrorism.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Environmental terrorism are terrorist attacks directed against the environment. Eco-terrorism is an act of violence committed to against basically humanity in pro-nature. Okay. So the simplest definition is the eco-terrorist movement developed primarily in the 1980s, though a lot of it began in the 60s, involves members of a predominantly middle-class background who are in deliberate contrast to the mainstream ecological and animal protection groups, which, according to eco-terrorists, have not achieved any radical change in the protection of the environment. So these are a lot of people who, like he says, they've tried to work with the system. They have petitioned. They have protested. They have tried to get articles out. And all of the things that they're told are the rational, calm, democratic, societally acceptable ways of being heard. They don't feel are doing what needs to be done. I mean, we just relatively recently, for example, there was a production of Les Miserables on the West End.
Yes. Great example. London. Yeah.
And oil protesters got up on stage and interrupted the Act One finale by chaining themselves to the stage and protesting. That is still within the realm of following the system. They are peacefully interrupting and forcing people to listen to them. Mm-hmm. Eco-terrorism is born of people believing that that is not enough and it's not doing what needs to be done. It is extremism. Arose out of the same school of thought that brought about deep ecology, ecofeminism, socioecology, and bioregionalism. It was the concept of ecoterrorism was not coined until the 60s. The history of it obviously precedes that, but the concept of it within our vernacular really began in the 60s, and then it really grew to prominence in the 80s. So ecoterrorist acts may occur in various forms. Some include equipment vandalism, blockades to business or work sites, package bombs or pipe bombs sent to institutional administrators, liberation of animals, destruction of research data, invasion of government or business offices to commit crimes of civil disobedience, arson of buildings, obliteration of experimental plants and animals, etc. They commit these acts and many other acts in a fight to save nature. By taking claim for these acts, eco-terrorists acquire public attention and use that interest to spread their extreme environmentalist ideologies that demand a reduction of human alteration to the natural environment. And the thing that is difficult with this is that the line between what is considered protesting and civil disobedience and criminal acts of eco-terrorism gets very gray. And it's something that's still happening to this day. Some examples of tactics as well are tree spiking. first used by Earth First in 1984. It involves hammering small spikes into the trunk of a tree that may be logged with the intention of damaging the chainsaw or mill blades. But it could also seriously hurt the loggers, which is where it starts becoming a violent act. Arson, obviously, bombing. Monkey wrenching is a tactic popularized by Edward Abbey in his book, The Monkey Wrench Gang, which that involves sabotaging equipment that is environmentally damaging. Again, the huge thing about this is that the idea is to stop the humans and the machines from hurting the environment. But the step into ecoterrorism is usually when they start harming the humans in the practice.
Yeah.
There are many groups that have been accused of ecoterrorism, and that's where I'm not going to get into who is technically an ecoterrorist. Some organizations that have been accused in the United States include the Animal Liberation Front, ALF, the Earth Liberation Front, ELF, the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, Earth First, as I previously mentioned, the Hardesty Avengers, and one that I think is very unique to this episode, which is very similar in name, which is the Coalition to Save the Preserves.
Yeah.
As opposed to our friends here who are the Coalition to Preserve America's Resources.
Yeah. Oh, interesting. Yeah, that's pretty close.
Mm-hmm. So there are some more modern groups such as Greenpeace and PETA who have been accused. It is all alleged. I am not here to say whether or not they are.
Sure.
But I will say that in 2010, the FBI was criticized in the U.S. Justice Department reports for unjustified surveillance and placement on the terrorism watch list between 2001 and 2006 of those groups. So it's become a thing where people are proactively assuming ecoterrorism with groups that may or may not be interested in that, but who definitely kind of tap dance along the lines of protest and criminal disobedience. Speaking of the Coalition to Save the Preserves, it was mentioned in FBI testimony as a group that was responsible for a series of arsons in Arizona. Using similar tactics to ELF, they caused more than $5 million in damages. So it's a difficult conversation to have, and it's a slippery slope, but that is still an ongoing conversation. For example, spiking trees became a federal offense in the United States in 1988. When we talk about extremism, there's even extremism within ecoterrorism.
Of course, yeah.
The lines people are willing to go. So when she says, like, ecoterrorism is not the way you want to go, these young gentlemen are on just, they are on the cusp of possibly becoming ecoterrorists by kidnapping someone, but it could get so much worse. And I genuinely don't believe any of these young men will become ecoterrorists, but I do think that they believe they've been pushed to a point where they have to do something radical that could be considered illegal. Now, I think a lot of the gray area comes from who decides what is illegal and for what reason. That's where the gray area lands. Yeah. So thank you for listening to my TED Talk. Please go research it yourself. It is very nuanced and extensive.
Yeah, as much of life is. So we're back in the Winnebago. Many hours have passed. It's been two hours. It's been 2 hours that Murphy has been sitting in a moving Winnebago with a bag on her head. And you know what? She deserves it. It is, of course, a reusable grocery bag, canvas, I believe. It says Save the Trees.
Sure does, because they are on brand.
On brand. And she's tied to a swivel chair. They're arguing over a map because they're obviously lost. And then we get another Gary Hart joke.
Yeah, we love talking about Gary.
And this is where we see that Marshall is being very sweet, right? He's like, can I call you Murphy?
Sweet Marshall.
Yeah. And she's like, get this bag off my head. So they decide to park. They take the bag off of her head, and there's a great thing where she goes, what is in there, old broccoli? And then she spits. Again, the physical comedy from Candace in this episode is just, is fantastic. Mm-hmm. Very funny. She says that they're not going to win. You know, they're not going to sort of strong arm her to do the story, consent to this. But she still, you know, has them call Phil's, to which Phil doesn't want to hand the phone to Miles if he doesn't get a last name. Because apparently Smith doesn't sound like a real last name. But he's fine with Alex Trebek calling on a payphone at Phil's.
Yep.
But go, Phil. So at first, of course, everyone is concerned. Oh, no. And then they laugh because they think it's a prank. So we're back in the Winnebago, and we can hear through the phone that everyone is singing Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead. To which one of them goes, these are your friends? And they talk about how they should have really taken Joan London. People love Joan London.
People love Joan London.
Starts defending herself that she's clever and witty and people find her fun to be around. People don't know Joan London was one of the hosts of the ABC morning show, Good Morning America. So she was definitely someone that people found warm and inviting over their breakfast.
I mean, the difference between a morning host and an evening host is notable.
And then she tries calling somebody else.
Well, and then we get to find out who this next person is. It's Howard at the Post. She's on the phone with Howard. She tells him it's an incredible story. And she's giving it to him because they've been friends for so long. Howard talks, and then we just hear, oh, come on, Howard, it's been 6 months since she sent a phony IRS agent to his office. Clearly, Howard hangs up.
Karma. It's karma.
It's karma. Elliot cries that it's incomprehensible, which I just have to stop and say.
Yes.
Is the most Wallace Shawn adjacent inconceivable.
Oh, read? Good point. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because you have to believe that these two men were constantly being compared to each other. Sweet. Curtis Armstrong and Wallace Shawn for being a very specific physical type and vocal type.
I can see that,
and
yeah.
Character type. And so when he says it's incomprehensible, I was just like, it's inconceivable. Like, it's just.
That's good, yeah.
Same person. She's made 37 phone calls, apparently. And he says, do you know the statistical probabilities of no one believing her? Sweet Marshall swoops in. Gentleman of the hour points out, hey, at least she's trying. Which is true. I also feel like the audience is like, aw. Because then he kneels down in front of her.
Yeah.
And you hear this little murmur from the audience because Sweet Marshall. And he asks her, isn't there someone else? Like, Alan Alda. Why don't you try Alan Alda? He seems like someone who believes people. And she shrieks out, I don't know Alan Alda.
Ugh, I love the way she says that. I know I keep saying that, but just that's another line reading that I'm just like, ugh. I don't know Alan Alda.
I also just have to call out, like, Alan Alda, notably throughout his career, has been like a science forward climate activist.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Do you remember his Scientific American Frontiers gig where he was the
host? And I listened to his podcast too, where it was like a little sciencey. Yeah. He's also just like kind of like Henry Winkler in the sense of like the reputation of like just a nice guy to know.
I have so many memories of Alan Alda smiling at scientists on the TV. The kindest man in the world. He hosted Scientific American Frontiers from 1993 to 2007 for 81 episodes. He just like in the last several years has been going and like putting a face to the climate change effects up in Alaska, which I'm very partial to since I spent half my childhood there. But I just love that we reference Alan Alda because you know what? He is somebody who would listen to people and believe them. And scientists in particular, they say she doesn't have to yell. She says, yes, I do have to yell. Yes, I'm yelling. I'm yelling. I'm yelling. I'm yelling. And while she's just yelling that she's yelling, Alex returns with some food.
Oh, does he?
And she's starting to dig in at the little table. And that's when Marshall, Sweet Marshall, realizes that Alex brought back a plastic bag.
Mm.
Frustrated, says, okay, yeah, he forgot the canvas bag. Okay.
It was on Murphy's head.
That's true. It was on her head. Elliot reminds him of the policy. He has to take it back and explain to the manager that the molecular structure of plastic makes it virtually impossible to biodegrade. And one of my favorite Craig Bierko lines, yeah, I'm really going to explain that to a kid wearing an I Love Satan t-shirt.
Ooh.
And this is when we start to see what we were referencing earlier when we said that Murphy's not in danger here. She always has the upper hand and the position of power, whether they know it or not. And she just starts chiming in casually from her meal and says, right, he's the leader. Of course, that doesn't mean he'll get less jail time, even though he's the one who got you into all of this. And Marsha goes, hey, you know what? She's right. He didn't want to do a kidnapping. He wanted to do a bike-a-thon. And Alex leaps up and says, you know what? Someone else lead. Be my guest. And Marsha says, sure, he'll lead. And Elliot goes, you? You can't be the leader. Murphy casually unpacking her meal. Why not? Back to the boys. Elliot's taking over, actually. And Alex says, you? Are you kidding me? You can't even run an overhead projector. Murphy, starting to take her drink, says, they don't appreciate you, Elliot. It's very clear they don't listen to you. And dramatically starts sipping her drink with wide eyes.
Oh my God. That is my favorite thing I've ever seen Candace Bergen do, with the little tiny carrot juice. Drinking in the little thing. And then her eyes just sort of dart to the side like boop, she fucking knows that she's like poisoning the well with them. And it's just like fantastic.
Well, and what I love is because Murphy is such a strong kind of dramatic character, we rarely get to see Candace play a soft hand tactic.
Yeah.
The devil on the shoulder of each of these men. So chill in the background. so chill, so in control, just sipping with her wide eyes. They haven't figured this out yet, so they start arguing more. And Murphy is just, we keep cutting to her, just like sipping gleefully.
This is
just so... just quietly at her little table.
Their entire conversation, but particularly his, like, I'm supposed to be happy we're in ice ages coming, is like, this is so still good. Relatable.
It's so relatable. That's what's like, I'm like, I am on these boys' side. And honestly, so is Murphy. That's what's funny about it. I think yeah. that's why the stakes are so interesting, because she does agree with them, but she can't change the fact that she can't get the story out.
Yeah.
Chaos erupts. They're yelling over each other. And finally, Alex comes to his senses, yells, hold it, and stamps his foot. And Murphy's in this moment, Candace is so good, in that exact moment, her grin of joy of the chaos just drops so innocently, and we're back to big-eyed confusion. And he says, she's pitting them against each other, the old divide and conquer. And Candace picks up the biggest pickle, whole pickle, not sliced pickle, whole jumbo pickle, and just goes, pickle? It's incredible. This is some of my favorite Murphy Brown acting ever.
It really is, and I'm so glad you agree, and we'll put some clips. But obviously you can watch the episode as well off of our website. But the thing that also gets me that I just dawned on is what a contrast this is to when she was kidnapped on the air.
Yes.
Obviously, because there is a gun missing. There is not a gun yep. in this scene. It is very, yep. very different. But it still goes to the point of which, like, it's not just that I can't do your story because I need to do the research. I need to talk to both mm-hmm. parties. I need to do my due diligence as a journalist.
So that I ruined my credibility.
Yeah. But I also am not going to kowtow to terrorists, right?
No.
Like, you're not going to force me to. So it's the same yep. thematically. It's kind of the same. It's just that this is it actually is. An important issue. And before it wasn't.
And she actually wants to get this out. But because we are in a dramedy here, she yeah. has pranked too many people in Washington, D.C.
So some time has passed and we're still in the Winnebago because we have mm-hmm. not left this set pretty much. Murphy is still unfazed by being kidnapped. She's watching television. She's complaining. She's becoming the kidnapper's worst nightmare.
Uh-huh.
She wants Marshall to be her remote control. At one point, there's a feminine hygiene commercial to which Murphy goes, oh, lovely, a feminine hygiene commercial. Hey, fellas, let me just tell you that not once have I played Frisbee on a beach while discussing freshness. I think about this line every time I see any sort of commercial about my period.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get on to Larry King, which Murphy jokes that she should have called him. And they all realize that this is genius. Now, for those people who are not familiar with the 90s version of the Larry King show and not the
yes.
Larry, I'm on DuckTales Hulu version.
I'm on DuckTales, Larry.
I'm on DuckTales, Larry. His show on CNN would have a section of it where people could call in.
Yeah.
And he would be like, Bethesda, Maryland. You know, he would say where you were from. And Kevin Pollak used to do this thing on his chat show where it was like a game where he would tell people to do a Larry King impression, call out a strange town, and then say something personal about themselves that Larry had just discovered, you know? So it would be like, mm-hmm. Kalamazoo, Wisconsin, I've eaten too much bread. And that's a stupid one.
Yeah.
But like, you know, it would just be sort of crazy like that. So apparently this is what he was known for. Because Larry King at the time particularly was a very, well, he is like a prestigious newsman. I'm just going to very briefly give people a little history who may not be familiar with Larry King. Who really, I think many of us, even the two of us, probably know from impressions on SNL,
mm-hmm.
more of a caricature later in life as an older gentleman.
Yeah.
King is not his real last name, which I did not know. He was born in Brooklyn, Lawrence Ziegler, but actually changed his name when he first became a CBS staff announcer in Florida, which apparently was like a big market, after King's Wholesale Liquor.
Sure.
Yeah. And he was really kind of a local celebrity for a while. And what I think is sounds like it's out of a movie. Like his first celebrity interview was because he moved there in like the late 50s. A lot of what we're talking about is like the late 50s, right? By the late 50s, he has this sort of mid-morning show on WIOD at the Pumpernickel restaurant in Miami Beach, where he would just interview people who came in. And literally 2 days later, Bobby Darin, who had been listening and liking what was going on, just like walked in and he interviewed Bobby Darin. And it sort of started this sort of history of him being this celebrity interviewer. Gleason also did something very similar where he had a show by 1960 and Gleason was filming a variety show nearby and he would just kind of come in and helped him change the set and became sort of a mentor to him. So a lot is based on his talent, but also just based on sort of happenstance that he was like, oh, I hear Florida apparently has got a you know, huge broadcasting community. I'm going to go there. During his career, he is said to have conducted 60,000 interviews. His show Larry King Live is the longest running television show hosted by the same person on the same network in the same time slot and is recognized by the Guinness Book of World Records.
Dang.
Because eventually he, in 1985, went to CNN with his show, which was something that I had not realized because it was like, oh, I only know him from CNN. He must have had a show before that. And of course he did. He retired in 2010 after taping 6,000 episodes of his show. And that is when he did the Hulu show in 2021. I've heard rumors that he was sort of pushed away because of his age. You know, they didn't really want to retire, which makes sense that he went and did a show, which is what I think people know him from. But there are tons of clips. There's a famous Carrie Fisher clip where she mocks men, Debbie Reynolds doing impression of Meryl Streep. It was anyone from big political people to celebrities. It was sort of kind of like Barbara Walters, I feel like, for cable, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
Time magazine referred to him as the master of the mic. And Larry King played himself a lot on television shows around this time. And he will come back to Murphy Brown later on in the run of the show.
Oh, he sure will.
Yes, he will. I love the fact that she calls and she's like, hi, Pat, can you put me on? Like, she knows everybody, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, she knows whoever's answering the phones. But Larry doesn't believe her at all. We do find out that she's been kidnapped for 12 hours now. I should mention that. But apparently, Murphy does this a lot. She called and pretended to be Salman Rushdie. And he goes, oh, a great journalist and a good buddy, Murphy Brown. So it's really not working.
No, the second that he shows that, like, friendly affection for her, you're like, oh, no. The second he recognizes her like as a friend, you're like, this isn't working.
Yeah, you crazy kid. Ha ha ha. Let's go to the next call. It's like that. And so we now get to the point where Murphy has been such a horrible kidnappee that they open the door and try to get her to leave, which she doesn't get.
What I love is the way that they, like, she goes to the bathroom. And they're trying to figure out what to do because all of their options are gone at this point. It's not working.
She's driving them crazy.
She starts complaining about hair in the soap and then from the bathroom. And they all just start being like, what if? So that they don't lose their ground as strong men. They're like, what if someone just forgot the door was open? And they set up this whole scenario. And she's so focused on complaining about her hose being ruined that she just completely misses that the door is wide open. And one of my favorite quotes, forgive me for paraphrasing because I didn't write this down, but I love the way that Craig Bierko kicks her out of the Winnebago, which he basically tries to really gently say, the ends don't justify the means. And they have other legitimate avenues they could possibly explore. And she's asking, like, what do you mean? And then he finally just erupts on her and screams at her to get out. And he says they would rather go to jail, drive back to Oregon, or eat off the floor of a nuclear power plant than work with her. Ugh, and she is so miffed.
I mean, it's so perfect for Murphy, right? And in the third season where we're like, we know her, we get it. Of course, she's going to drive them crazy that they let her go.
I love the way she's like, well, okay. She's so miffed.
And then the gang walks by and it's like, oh, this is where you've been. You know, are you buying
a Winnebago?
Yes, because
she asked, can you drive me back to FYI? And they're like, we've been parked outside it for hours. And the gang's like, oh, hey.
And then she just pretends like it was a joke and like runs after them. It's so great.
Yep. It's just so good. I love it. She's like, can I at least get a ride? They're like, we're already here.
We've been trying. So here's a question about this episode, right? Which is something that I think has been a debate online, particularly because it has been brought up as a cause by one of my favorite critics at Vulture, Catherine, and I hope I say her name right because as a dyslexic, Catherine Van Arendonk, is that people have the wrong idea about what a bottle episode is. Mm-hmm. So before I tell you what she says a bottle episode is versus how other people say it, I would love to just quickly have this discussion. What do you think is a bottle episode? And do you think this one is a bottle episode?
So here's the deal. I feel very pressured because we have an expert writing about it.
Okay. I can just go to this. I'm just curious your thoughts.
But no, yeah. but what I like about this, because of course I know the thing you're referencing, I love that there's an actual test for it.
Yes, which I thought we would take after we're done having this discussion.
So for me, when I think of bottle episode, without claiming that I know the correct definition, when I hear bottle episode, it's an episode that I think the youths would call filler in a derogatory way.
Yes, definitely been called that, yeah.
Which filler I don't think is derogatory. I just think people have forgotten how to watch long-form television.
Agreed.
But it's an episode that kind of takes place within its own bottle, within its own container. And sometimes it has like bookends or interjections of the world we're used to being in. Like we have the gang at the top and in interjections throughout this, but that the action itself often takes place within a small container that doesn't affect the larger series plot.
I like that. And in that sense, I think that this is a bottle episode, but I wonder based on what Catherine says, if it actually is. But here, this is what the definition, it says, usually it's as a result, the strictest definition, this is what Catherine says, of a bottle episode is an episode that's filmed entirely on one pre-built standing set, includes only main cast members, and is cheaper and faster to produce than a standard episode. But this isn't only on one set. It's not an old set, and it doesn't have pretty much any of the other characters. But as structurally, it does seem like it is a bottle episode, right?
And I would say the main meat of the episode being the Winnebago is one set.
Absolutely. Now, the biggest example of a bottle episode is most people bring up Seinfeld's The Chinese Restaurant, which if people don't know it, even if you're not a Seinfeld fan, you can sort of drop into it and watch it. And it's great. It really was the turnaround for the show that made people really pay attention to it. Now, what she says is that bugs her is that people are now referring to what are standalone episodes, like the wordless episode of Only Murders in the Building, the long, long time episode of The Last of Us. I would say Blink and Doctor Who is a great example, that they are not taking place on one set. They are just standalone episodes that you can watch and not have to know the entire series. You can sort of drop into them. And that I do agree with. So that's why I love Catherine.
I totally agree with that. I actually appreciate the clearer definition for that reason, because I love standalone episodes and sometimes they are world building and are used very cleverly. I think Doctor Who's a great example of some of these standalone episodes.
Yeah, like a lot of them are like, oh, we're stuck in this freezer, or we're stuck in this safe, or
like Community made a rule of it, of having them like stuck in the study room, or stuck in, you know, like that kind of thing. Those are some, like some shows have actually made that a form that they use often. That's part of like their comedy or commentary, which I think is really fun.
She also refers to that the standalone episode is also can be referred to as a departure episode, which then widens the description of it. I should also say that Catherine is a huge Murphy Brown fan and is like, loves an excuse to talk about Murphy Brown. So that also helps too.
So I love in the next section of this article, someone says, or it's a pose as a question. Can I call these filler episodes? She says, no, you may not. She says, well, okay, clip shows did serve the purpose of padding out a season. But filler, as it's typically used now, doesn't mean anything specific about a category of episodes. Instead, it's roughly deployed to mean, I thought this episode was boring, or this episode is doing character development, but it's not advancing the plot I care about.
Yeah.
So I really appreciate this actual definition, because I think it helps me having the categories of standalone or departure, bottle, and filler, although I hate filler and I just don't use it, but having that kind of delineation is useful in conversation.
Yeah, no, it's really great. And I love that this is sort of the hill that she likes to stand on. And I recently, I guess it was a while ago, I saw on her Instagram, someone made her a friendship bracelet that says, it's not a bottle episode.
Yes.
And so now here's the thing. I think the word bottle episode, which I agree with Catherine, became a lot more in the vernacular because of Community.
Yep. But especially with him actually saying, it's a bottle episode.
I do find it interesting that it's the idea to save money, which definitely makes sense. So we're going to take a test right now in real time from the Vulture article that will tell us if this episode is a bottle episode. Are you ready, Jesse?
I am so ready.
Okay. So question number one, Does the episode take place entirely on a set the show regularly uses? So that's a no.
No.
To question three, it's not the whole episode, but bottle episode do often have one or two small scenes that take place somewhere else. Yes. Does 90% of the episode happen on a set the show regularly uses? Well, no. So that's why it's a little like, okay, so no. Okay, but does the vast majority of the episode happen inside one interior space? Yes. We're talking about a single room, an apartment, or several rooms inside a home or workplace. Yeah, it does.
Yes.
Okay. Wait, not all workplaces are the same. Is this like the office building from Severance? A Byzantine set of hallways and rooms full of goats and dance parties that needed months for the light board to program? No.
Nope.
Is it just the show's main cast? See, that's why this is so hard, right? No.
Well, I would say, like, I would argue if it was, like, if it was majority. So if it was, like, three of the gang and one guest star, but the fact that it's three guest stars and one of the gang.
Well, that's the next
question.
It is
the lead of the show. Right? So anyway, we're going to question seven.
How many guest stars with speaking roles are involved? More than three. No.
No.
No, not more than three. So that takes us to, does the episode have other pricey add-ons?
Nope.
CGI stunts? No. Is the different form a standard episode of the show, fewer people, just one standing set instead of four, takes place over a shorter period of time? Then yes.
I would say yes.
It's a bottle episode.
It's a bottle episode.
I was not expecting that answer.
I love this so much.
There's a framework to what is a bottle episode, but I think it's more about what isn't a bottle episode as opposed to.
I think that's the key. What I like about that is that we're grading on a curve. The thing that kept us from believing it was a bottle episode was primarily the number of guest stars. But that was the only element that really took it away from that. And the fact that an 85% versus 100%, but that's still passing.
And I think it comes down to just like using the words correctly and a love of television to want to use them correctly. Just
that
like we
so
feel
fun.
About the difference between saying reboot and revival. Mm-hmm. There is a distinct difference.
Yep. That was so fun. Yay us.
Yeah, that was fun. Okay. All right. So any last things that you'd like to add to Rootless People?
Only that I really do want a modern version of her outfit. I am going to say this right now. I'm going to try and figure out a way to recreate this in my current fashion. So if you enjoyed this episode as much as us, or if there are other episodes of similar or just completely different TV shows that you did the test with, we would love to know. I would love to know what other episodes of popular series people are wondering about. Please go use this little quiz. It made me very happy. I feel like I need to go down a list of other ones that I enjoy to figure that out.
Yeah, we will link it on the show notes on our website so you can take the test yourself.
Thank you for listening, friends.
If you enjoyed what you heard today, please show us your support by
liking,
subscribing,
and interacting with us on social media.
Our handle everywhere is
at Murphy Brown Pod.
You can also email us at
murphybrownpod@gmail.com
or visit our website at
murphybrownpod.com.
Share us with your friends.
Give us a 5-star rating
wherever you listen to podcasts.
You can also support the podcast by checking out our Patreon.
You can donate once
or be a recurring subscriber
and access exclusive deep dives on Murphy Brown and other related topics,
as well as bonus content we had to cut for time.
100% of what you donate goes toward creating this podcast.
So any way you are able to support, we deeply appreciate.
And we'll see you next time
for another edition of FYI,
the Murphy Brown Podcast. Oh, I was editing the bottle episode for final cuts, and I realized something that I should have said, which was that after we took the test, I thought, oh, we tested positive for bottle episode. And I was like, you thought of that now?
Oh,
you
man.
Thought of that now?
It's what we get.